Thank you. Can we send it down and can I ask Professor Kudlitsky to take to the rightful place? There we go.
Honorable members of Parliament, it's my privilege to be here this morning to share my reflections on the recent directions in monetary policy in South Africa. My presentation is going to take a little different slant from the very useful and illuminating presentation by Professor Chessie, whom I'm very happy to be here, and also a close personal friend of mine and a colleague. In thinking about my presentation, I said to myself, what would members of parliament expect from me this morning? And I think that probably the first thing in your mind is, what can we do to contribute to the fight against inflation in this country? Perhaps the mandate of the Reserve Bank wanted to fixate on controlling inflation through using the only instrument available, which is probably interest rates. But Parliament may not be so bound. It probably has a lot more instruments that it can use to contribute against the fight of inflation fighting the economy. And there's certainly a missing link in the fight against inflation. And I'm hoping that my presentation this morning can assist you to reflect in ways in which you can contribute to the fight against inflation. As is well known, in the U.S., for instance, the Congress and the civilians say that war is too important to be left to generals alone. So in the same way, the fight against inflation is also too important to be left to the economists and the central bank alone. I think it's a collective fight, and I'm hoping that my presentation this morning will force you to think about more innovative ways in which Parliament can bring in collective wisdom to assist in the fight against inflation. In trying to structure my presentation, I applied my mind to the mandate that contained in the letter that was sent to me by the chairman of the Portfolio Committee on Finance, Honorable Lennon. He has charged me to give a brief presentation on the overview of the March 2007 quarterly report, and I tried to do that briefly, highlighting some of the things that I think we should pay attention to. He also tasked me with giving a reflection on the recent Monetary Policy Committee decision, and I've looked at some of the monetary policy statements in February, in April, and in June, and tried to draw out certain commonalities across those policies that I think would also influence your thinking on how you can contribute to the fight against inflation. And finally, I also, if time permits, would like to share some views on the concept of saving and saving in South Africa. Because very often we hear that either we're not saving enough, or we don't save at all, or we don't have a culture of saving. And I would also like to say a couple of things in that direction, if time permits. But if not, it's also contained in the presentation, and we can always talk about it at some point in the future. So, as a parliamentarian, the question is, what can I do and what can I do? And the information I'm going to present to you here is supposed to address some of those issues about how can you help in the fight against inflation. My outline of presentation starts first by reflecting on the Monetary Policy Committee statement in 2007, then highlights of the March 2007 quarterly bulletin, which is what I have available, and implications of those for monetary policy. Let's begin with the reflections of the monetary policy statement of February 2007. Unfortunately, it does look like a resolution on my computer, I don't know. And so the font that I use, but since it's in the handout, I think you can see the rest of the point in the handout. So the fact is that in February 2007, the Reserve Bank took an improved outlook on inflation, with the CPI expected to peak at 5.6%. And the strong consumer demand was supposed to be sustained by asset price growth. This means that perhaps it's possible that consumers are borrowing either from second mortgages in their home, or those things stop in the stock market, that able to leverage those in order to improve their effective demand. And that rising meat prices were expected to be the main contributor to food price inflation. And that the robust rate extension growth in the corporate sector increased from 31% to 27%, whereas the credit extension to private sector declined to 24.3% from 26.1%. These trends are going to be important as we go along, as we see the trend, because the whole point about using interest rates to target inflation is that you have to be sensitive to which component of the basket that the central bank is targeting is sensitive to changes in interest rates. Because if some of those components are not sensitive to changes in interest rates, it may appear that we are actually getting a debt for. So this kind of trend is going to be important as we go ahead in looking at the monetary policy. If you look at the April statement, the outlook in February did not pan out because inflation has worsened despite the observed reduction of CPI from 5.6% to 5.6%. The outlook going forward was actually looking worse, and that was due to several factors. One of them being that the food price hike expected to decline, the food price hike as expected. Food price hikes were expected as well, despite the observed decline in meat price that was flagged in February as being the main contributor to increases in inflation. And also the falling footwear, falling the prices declined. These are components that are supposed to be very sensitive to interest rates. So it does look like inflation targeting using interest rates was actually working based on these indicators of consumer spending. There were, however, adverse developments in administered prices, and I think the administered prices had to do with components such as energy costs set by Eskom, which is something that was referring to. And there was also continued growth in private sector credit extensions. In particular, the growth in the 12-month bank loan, which means revolving credit like overdraft, increased by 0.7%. The asset-backed credit growth, such as living finance and total number of household loans, declined. Again, you can see the trend. The funds went down, the apparel went down, the footwear went down. Asset-backed credit growth, such as living and number of household loans, declined also. And the ratio of household debt to disposable income is rising. What this, of course, implies is that the burden of debt is increasing. Because as most of you know, even if you're not buying anything, if interest rate goes up, the proportion of your income that you're having to pay in mortgage is just going to go up. So when you measure that as the proportion of your income, which hasn't increased, the debt servicing burden is just going to increase, just by reason of the fact that interest rates have gone up. So that has nothing to do with the behavior of the consumer. Again, thinking about the fact that interest rates is supposed to influence the way English consumers behave. But if things continue to move despite the way that consumers behave, that also has implications for the way in which you fight inflation. And that is something that's one that should be in mind. Another issue that we need to focus on is that the Bureau of Economic Research at the University of Stellenbosch survey of inflation expectations that certain questions need to be raised with regard to that. One being, or what do the expectations, when you survey the consumer, what do they condition, upon what do they condition their expectations? How do they think about the future? You know, what are those key variables that people think based on? Is it based on the drought? Is it based on energy prices? Is it based on global peace and security? What is it, you know, we do not know. We simply know that people have been surveyed and this is their outlook about inflation. You know, it would be very helpful if we knew some of those variables upon which these expectations are conditioned. It's also very important to interrogate the information set upon which the CPI forecasts are based. If the central bank is forecasting future inflation, what are these forecasts based on? And that way we can actually interrogate the assumptions and the expectations and find out if they're realistic or otherwise. It does not take the rocket scientist in order to be able to either contradict or ask more questions or even interrogate, if you like, the basis of those expectations. Now, moving on to the June 2007 monetary policy committee statement, the CPIF inflation percent of rate is 6% of the target, and this was this rate was fueled by Trump introducing food and petrol price. Again, circumstances beyond the control of the consumer. If you actually exclude food and energy, it shows that the CPI inflation would have been held at 4.6%.
Which means that the interest rates
are supporting towards consumer behavior, that the interest rate target level is actually at the point in which that achieves the goal that is set for. And therefore, if you continue the policy, look at it in terms of the fact that if we are profligate, if we spend too much, we get punished to increase in the interest rate. But if you are punished us sufficiently, that the circumstances that you observe are no longer due to my own fault, why am I then continue to be punished by further increasing the interest rate? Taking, in fact, this very narrow view of the reason why interest rates are being increased and the fact that it's supposed to condition behavior in a certain direction. Think about trying to punish a child. If you're trying to condition the behavior of the child and they're now behaving in ways in which you expect, but there are other prevailing circumstances that may appear before the child to meet the end. But each time you observe the circumstances, you know the child. What kind of conditioning is that? So that is the way we can look at the fact that food and energy prices are responsible for this increase, that in fact, if you control for those, then inflation is under control. And yet, the consumer keeps getting the brunt of this inflationary control. Here lies the next is where I think the Parliament can come, and I will talk about that at the end of this overview of 2016. If you look at the petrol prices increase, actually in March and April, it moved from 7.9% to 15.5%. That's a whopping increase. And that, again, circumstances beyond the control of the consumer. And again, there's a strong upward trend, and I'm reading from the monetary policy statement, these are not my own words, I'm simply reading between the lines. The strong upward trend in prices are very broad, which of course suggests both a cost push inflation as well as a demand driven inflation. So there are two dimensions to both the demand side and the supply side of the inflationary process. And yet, the inflation target seems to be fixated on the demand side of inflation. Continuing in the same trend, the prices of household consumables appear to have increased. However, what we do not know is what kind of household consumables. Is it the school fees of the children that's not under the control of the consumer? Is it the insurance premium that you get on your policies and your car that is not under your control? Otherwise, of course, you can't pay your policy. Or is it the parking fees that you have to pay that is not under your control? These are supply side increases, and yet the person responds to them. If you go to work and you have to pay for parking, you have no choice. And so it's not something that interest rates can trust you to change, unless of course you stop driving to work. But that again is conditioned on alternatives such as mass transportation systems. If that is not an option, then there is no amount of interest rate increases that's going to change that are part of the consumer spending. And yet you get reflected that increases in consumer spending. So those increases also need to be unpacked so that we understand exactly what is going on. Clothing, footwear, furniture prices, recreation, entertainment, according to the Reserve Bank, continues on a downward trend. Those are kinds of things you should make up things that are profit spending. So those have already adjusted. And that is the kind of adjustment you would expect from monetary policy that fixes the inflation. So it's evident that consumers are already behaving, going back to my setup of our big up the size of the head. The rise in producer price inflation, on the other hand, has gone to 11.1% from 9.1% in March. And again, by the addition of the Reserve Bank, it's the highest since December 2002. Thereby, again, highlighting my point about the cost push and the demand driven inflation, and the need to be sensitive to both of those components of the inflationary trends that we observe in the economy. Private sector credit extension grew from 26.2% to 27.4% within 1 month. And mortgage advances, leasing finance, and installment sales did increase. Now, my question here is this a real growth and nominal growth? Because if the prices of cars are simply increased, even if you were selling the same cars, you actually have been sales as decreasing, but the past cost of the cars costs more, if you look at aggregate lending, it's supposed to show an increase. So looking at the nominal trends can sometimes be deceptive, particularly if the unit cost of those goods are actually going up in this environment. And particularly also if those components are imported price inflation. And this is then going to take us up to the issue of sense of trade. You know, what do we pay for things that we buy from other countries and what do other countries pay for things that we export? So again, these are issues that we need to be very sensitive to, but they're details and sometimes they're not brought up in discussions of monetary policy. Corporate sector credit extension accounted for the strongest increase in bank lending. So again, it's not the consumers, it's the corporate sector, and it's not clear to me here whether it's not a demand for increasing working capital. You know, again, I'm not sure what's driving the increase in corporate lending, but the increased cost of borrowing could push up product prices because if interest rates are going up and corporate sectors are borrowing more in spite of the increased interest rates, and they have the market power, this cost a bit passed on again to the consumer. And again, we see mainly the price of services, which again is reflected in the monetary policy statement, that one of the things components that have actually increased is the price of services, which suggests that the corporations are adjusting for the increase in the cost of borrowing, as well as increase in energy costs and cost of doing business in general. I suppose the only way in which consumers, since the market power can react to these things, they have to go in on the track. And we have seen in the past couple of months that there's been a sporadic increase in strikes, and it's not just in the public sector, even in universities, although people are very restive. And this is the only way they can express themselves. Corporations can pass on the cost, and the other countries can pass on the cost, but the consumers cannot pass on the cost, or people who work in the labor sector, and the only way is to generate recourse to the collective bargaining. And so again, to me, this is a manifestation of the dynamic, the power dynamic we see in the marketplace, and what makes and what lacks. It's probably the case that the corporate sector, the producers lead, because they can pass on those costs easily, and after a while, of course, when you get a stock of credit, plus your real income, the only thing you can do is to go to the bargaining table. And finally, if you, let's take a look at the big picture. Look at the inflation forecast from February, April, and June. The picture that emerges is that the Reserve Bank has consistently kept it wrong. And it doesn't quite mean that they do not know what they're doing. It simply means that the second countries are quite volatile. We do not know what is happening. And therefore, then there needs to be a lot more modest, in trying to pontificate. We do not know what's happening, and we can all dialogue together and discuss what should we do. Nobody should come and legislate, if I may use that word, and say, this is what we should do. It's 500 basis points will do the trick, 200 basis points will do the trick. There's just so many circumstances and changes in the world economy that modesty is called in trying to understand what's going on. And if you look at the February conference, the outlook was, as I said, well, it's expected to peak at 5.6% in 2007 and average at 4.7% in 2008. In April, the forecast was revised. It says below the upper level in 2007. Whatever that means, that's a very broad bet. It means we do not know what is happening. You know, that's how you hedge your bet, right? Saying below. You don't do a point estimate, they could be anywhere. It reminds you of the weather forecast. You can give a wide card, and when it rains, it doesn't rain, you just can't go wrong. An average at 5.1% in 2008. It's an average. And in June, it says marginally exceeds the 6% target level. Where is that margin? It could be anywhere. And it's supposed to peak at 6.6% in 2008. So these are the kind of forecasts that we're getting. But look at the actual CPI developments in 2007. That's what I said below. Now, between February and April, it declined to 5.2%. And in April and June, the CPIS, of course, went up to 6.2%. And so I do not, this is not the question I'm saying. It's a difficult business, that's all I'm trying to say here. Okay. And so these are my reflections on the February, April, and June. Now let me highlight some of the issues in the quarterly bulletin, and I'm going to try to put that together and see what implications are for both the Parliament and the Reserve Bank, as well as the Treasury. According to the bulletin, the real consumption expenditure by household, this is the profile of the consumption expenditure. The gross real expenditure on semi-durable goods have declined. The real expenditure on non-durable goods have increased. There's a slow growth on food, beverages, tobacco, as well as household consumer goods. It's a kind of theme, if you like, people expenditure. And there's strong growth. There's a strong growth in spending on household on fuel and its power, on medical, on pharmaceutical products, as well as petroleum products. This is again circumstances we have beyond the control of the consumer, and the real disposable income of households grew at a slower rate. And the ratio of household debt to household disposable income increased. Again, I talked about this in the monetary policy statement. And development in gross saving as a percentage of GDP. That's also something that we need to watch, and I'm going to show you a chance to speak to that. And the implication that it's probably a zero-sum game, because if you look at this chart here, you will see that the corporate saving appears to be going down, the household saving appears to be going down, but the government saving appears to be going up. It makes you think whether Parliament is passing the heck out of the consumers and the corporate sector. As if you make the laws and the revenue simply to collect the money. So again, this is a question for you to think about. Employment, that's also very important, because regardless of monetary policy, the real issue is, even if inflation was under control, at what cost? And that's something that never gets asked the question. It's good to have inflation under control, but like everything else, there's a cost and there's a benefit. What does it cost us actually to have an inflation? And those need to be made a little explicit. And Parliament has the right to ask that question. Sure, we might see that there is a decline in inflation, but at what cost? What is the cost here? Is it in terms of growth? Is it in terms of employment? Or something else? We can't talk about benefits without thinking about the cost. And it is quite, of course, gratifying to note that public sector employment gains have increased by approximately 520,000 jobs. But it's not very good that growth in the public sector employment trumps growth in the private sector. Ideally, we would like the private sector to be the driver of employment. So that's something that I find very disturbing. It's also very disturbing that employment in the manufacturing sector fell slightly, because if we want to be lacking competitive, we need to be pushing science and technology. That's something else we're having to talk about, as well as our manufacturing and competitiveness. Given that if you consider regional integration, South Africa has a great potential to sell to the rest of the region. People shouldn't be going to Dubai and then Europe to shop. They should be coming to South Africa, or we should be taking the products to the rest of the region. That's part of regional integration. So if our manufacturing is falling, particularly in the discourse with regard to the Asian drivers, the India and China, that is also very disturbing as a trend, and we need to keep our eyes on that. And the electricity subsector, somewhat most of taxing loss in employment. I'm not so much responsible for that, but I'm still proud of Parliament to be able to do that. But that's something that is very disturbing that we ought to keep an eye on and find out what's going on. With regard to pricing, CPIX inflation accelerated considerably since 2006. Petrol and food price hikes are the main catalyst for this development. Unfavorable weather findings have pushed up the base price, and production price inflation more than doubled since 2006, which again goes to my point about cost push and demand push inflation. That everywhere keeps putting emphasis on the fact that you need to take a balanced view to look at the supply side as well as the demand side of price inflation. And if we may apply our minds to the components of this basket of the CPIX, if we are paying the price for the inflation, so that it doesn't become taxation without representation, we ought to be able to say something about what goes into the basket that we're targeting. Because the if I have to pay the price for the cost of that implementation, I ought to have something to say about the components of that implementation that is being targeted. What gets it to be into that basket? So it's a win-win situation for the person that pays the cost as well as the benefits that come. Because if the benefits are true, they're skewed towards a different part of the population, but the cost is borne by everybody else, that is not an equitable distribution of cost of benefits. So it is very important for us to also interrogate the composition of the taxes of the system of the target. And if you look at this, the largest component is food and soft drinks, which should be then, of course, that everybody drinks on the border by buyback. And services including housing and transport, it would be very interesting to know what is in those services. And the school fees in there, and the parking in there, depending on where you live, and your conduction partner, you should be very interested in the composition of those services that join the system basket. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense to you. And I often have even this discussion in my own home, to say inflation is going down, but I don't see that when I get into fight with my members of my domestic household over what is happening when they come back from pick and pay. No. So it could be that inflation prices are going up, but I don't feel it. And that goes back to what's the composition of the basket, and does it reflect the society in which we live in? And if not, why not? Why is it not representative of the people? The other large component, of course, is other goods not included elsewhere. It would be very interesting to know what I included in those other goods. It's probably very clear, but Parliament needs to know that, and the general society not to convince that we are all in this fight together. And if I may direct your mind to a first reading to drink, you would see that between 2005 and 2006, that has been the largest, almost like a 300% increase in that. And again, that's not all related to the increase in grain prices and meat. Of course, the grain is even feeding the beef also. So in general, the food prices have been very significant. My comment, of course, is that because is what I've already said about other goods, and it's not clear what those moving prices are. And foreign trade is another component, of course, there's a border thing that you've got to pay attention to, besides employment and prices, is what is happening in foreign trade. Because that, of course, defines the wealth of nations. You know, if we are ending up foreign reserve, then we're in a very precarious position. The strong demand for imported goods has continued since 2006. And of course, it has deteriorated the current account. That is not looking very good, if that's what is happening, because the position of the current account has to do with expectations about emerging markets and what happens in the financial market. You know, sometimes when you have contagion runs and dislocations in the financial market, it has to do with expectations about the health of the current account balances. So that is something that we have to keep our minds now. Our sight on, and also those influence of course behavior outcome of our currency should be in a very free market environment. Crude oil imports caused 100% growth in the volume of imports, from 7% to 14%. So when you actually look at the growth in that growth, is gone from 7% to 14%. So that's like a doubling in the rate of growth of imports. So that is very significant, and that is very troubling. And the current account deficit, even though it's well financed by inflows of foreign credit, but that again is not part of the couple. Just because you can borrow to finance our current account deficit does not make it very interesting. It's still very disturbing that we're running a current account deficit. And you can look at that here in terms of real imports and exports, that the difference between our imports and exports seems to be widening compared to the situation in 2004 and 2005. And that, to me, again, is a very disturbing trend. Now, what is the implications of looking at the foreign sector, the price, the employment for monetary policy? Well, the most serious question, given the current development, is which component of borrowing are more sensitive to interest rates, and how much do these components feed into the inflation that the Reserve Bank is targeting? If you are using, to rephrase that again, if you're using interest rates, if that's the only instrument available to the Reserve Bank, and the Reserve Bank is targeting a profile or a collection of items in the basket, we would like to know the elasticity of the demand for those various components to increase the interest rate. Because it's quite possible that the more you increase the interest rate, may not have any effect on how the price or even consumer demand for some of those items. If it is food and it's basic food items, and people depend on minimum or main, even if the interest rate goes up to 70%, people are just still going to drop off and start hiding in the street because they're going to want to eat. And so it's very important for us to look at the correlation between the sensitivity of those components of items in the food basket to the changes in interest rate over time. And you have a right to demand that you be fair for this information so you can make your own determination. That is the implication that anything comes to mind. Now, let me change directions a little and make some provocative statements that I would like Parliament to think about. And it's about what I call the missing money and non-inflationary assets. Let me give you a very simple example. Suppose that my bank is perfectly happy to charge me 6% interest for my mortgage. But as a consequence of inflation target and of rising inflation, my bank now charges me 14%. That's an 8% is what I borrow to the bank. This is money that was, they really do not care about it. I mean, the perfectly they have to lend me at 6%, but now they're lending me at 14%. So that 8% is almost the windfall gain, or what I may call a non-inflationary tax. Let me see the tax that I'm prepared to pay. It has increased in my mortgage cost that I'm prepared to pay as long as the price of inflation. Now, the question is, if the bank gets to keep its profit, this is one of those circumstances in which no matter how bad the economy does, bank profits keep going up. If the profits that the banks are making, and I'm suggesting this as a provocative statement, suppose that this profit leads into increases in dividends, and increases in the profit of the banks, who are the stakeholders of those banks? Who gets the dividends in those banks? If this is a bonus, if this is a windfall increase, the standard consumption theory says that the marginal propensity to consume out of windfall increases is actually higher than the propensity to consume out of the normal money. So what it means therefore is that while the poor people are acting their bills, the rich people are opening the bank because they can afford to consume. Because they're getting money from the same inflationary taxes that we're all paying. In an economy in which income distribution is highly skewed, this is very equitable distribution. Why can't we collect those inflationary taxes and use it to invest in science and technology? And this is where I'm saying that cost push and demand push inflation can be caused by investment in research and development. And this is something we never thought about. We keep complaining about energy prices going up. We keep complaining about drought, the food crisis. Why can't we invest into research and development in drought-resistant crops? If Israel can grow food in the desert, why can't we grow food and we're not as diversified as the Middle East? Why is it something that people use science and technology to confront this problem? Every time certain countries in the region, either it's underwater or above water, it happens all the time. Many countries in West Africa are plagued by this plague that keeps coming. The local towns that keep on crops. These are things that science and technology can address. If we start into biotechnology, mass transit systems, alternative energy, I do not have to drive to Parliament, maybe I can take the tube, maybe I can take the train system, and therefore we'll drive less. So the point is we should not be based by simply looking at inflation using the traditional measures such as interest rate rises. There should be other things that we can do to help. And maybe the Reserve Bank can do this alone, but this is where Parliament has the power to intervene, to call in other ways of looking at to fighting inflation. Of course, you do not have to change the bank and take away the windfall gains, but I do use that as an example that it's quite possible that this money that we collect, excess revenue, can be plowed into human resources, into science and technology. We have a technology problem in Pretoria. Then we can increase the funding. Already South Africa is a world leader in synthetic fuel technology. It does show you what you can do. Every country in the world has tried to solve their problems using science and technology. It's not only by raising interest rates. The time has come for us to give more emphasis on science and technology. I know it seems sort of odd for Greece to be coming from an economist or from a reserve bank, but in growth, everybody knows that technological improvement is that particular residual when you do a growth theory and you look at the residual, everything is human resource depends on technology. And Parliament won't take the lead. That is the central my message that I want to send to Parliament, and the fact that it's not a one-sided fight, it's both a demand push and a cost push, and the fact that technology can help in that cost push. Finally, if you would permit me, I would like to visit some very important issue in the matter of savings. Give me a second to take my slide. I know I've taken much of your time, and I also think this is very important. I'd like to start by quoting Julius Caesar here. It says, "The poor young British is not in ourselves, but in ourselves." And I will soon show you why maybe savings is a crisis cause in South Africa and the concept of savings. But one thing I would also like you to think about is this famous quote by Daniel Dell on the cultural contradictions of capitalism. It reminds me of the quote by Benedict Scrooge in Christmas Carol. He says, "There is nothing in which is so hard as poverty, and there is nothing which professes to condemn with such severity as the pursuit of wealth." The contradiction here is, while the one thing that ultimately describes the new capitalism is the serious practice of deferred gratification. What if for once we all stop going to the mall, and we all sit at home and stop buying? Can you imagine what will happen to the economy of South Africa? So it's a two-sided issue about how much you have to save and how much you have to spend. And I don't think that capitalism has quite gotten the balance right, because on the one hand you want the economy to boom based on consumer spending, and the other you want it to save. But if everybody's saving, there's no production now, which will enter into depression. And the point I want to make with this picture is the concept of capital formation, the concept of saving, that perhaps when you look at the Western mainstream literature, you might think that Africa in general does not save. But that is because of the way in which we measure savings in Africa. The fact that in many countries in Africa, because of the both the income level and the rural urban distribution of the people do not deviate their savings to financial institutions and the formal sector. People can save directly. You get a lot of money, you buy a piece of work. So if you drive through the last years in Africa, you see all these uncompleted buildings. These are people's savings. They save, they buy a little pen, and then they get the block, and then they get the banks, and then they get the people who are there for the roof. So they do not spend sometimes put their money in the bank, and they get a bank financing because of the intersections in financial markets and access to credit. So sometimes there's a direct transfer of capital formation from the money you make to the capital that you build. And so those influences the way in which we invest the city. Mm-hmm. The trading and direct investment, how do people invest within the African continent that takes into account the reality of our economy. So you often get that we sell too little, we do not sell enough. But what are the different ways of measuring savings in developing countries? That is very, very important. And how do institutions influence savings? And there is a difference between savings and saving. Savings is the accumulated income over time that is not consumed, but saving is the habit itself. Yes. So the question that we should be asking when you say that we save too little or we do not save enough, is people are very poor, they can't save. Their saving is going to be low. Even if you're a very good saver, suppose that my income is too high. Even if I save 90%, it's still going to be very poor. But if I'm a zero here, even if I'm saving 1% of that, that is going to be a large accumulated saving. So very often we do not make that distinction between saving, which is the habit itself, and saving, which is the accumulated income over time, which is a flow. And therefore, the emphasis is on the factors that influence saving and the factors that influence saving. And the definitional problems that they encounter when you apply the concept of saving in the context of Africa can be greatly involved in use of variables such as dependency ratio. How can you say that somebody does not save when he's taking care of 14 children, extended family, your uncle, your neighbors? Where does the money come from? From a very small income base, you're able to leverage that and make a lot of difference in the society within which you live. So because of the way in which we mediate our savings, sometimes it's not well captured, and that is something that needs to be done in mind. And the way, the also how you measure savings, investment in education is seen as consumption. And yet, building human capital is seen as very important. Okay? So that is an issue. Most people can train their children in training school, and yet it's part of their consumption expenditure. And intergenerational consideration in the savings equipment model means that people care about their families. And yet, we have extended families to take care of, and it's not, again, giving, recognized in the traditional measure of saving. And yet, in the literature, they talk about the quick money, which means that you need money. People say you should save so you can leave something for other generations. But suppose we're already taking care of those generations in our lifetime, which is why you cannot leave that saving that you're going to keep with. And so these are issues that one needs to take into account. And what are the basics of saving? Finally, saving does not depend on income. Saving, on the other hand, depends on income. And self-control, sometimes people say that we do that Africans do not save because they lack self-control. That is putting too much emphasis on cognition, in other words, the brain, without having to take into account other things like the environment and the messages that we see within the environment in which we live. And that's the difference between homo economicus and homo psychologicus, if you want to look at that. The role of economic structures and processes, preference, formation, material acquisitions, and satisfactions are prioritized in society. What should they call affluenza? Rather than influenza, but the affluent society and the way that people try to regulate the other person. Yeah, and again, just to make the point about saving and wealth. If you live in this kind of society or this type of environment, your saving is naturally going to be very low, even if you have a very good saving habit or a culture. On the other hand, if you live in this environment, perhaps even if you do not save that much, then the amount of savings because of your income level may be high. So we again need to be able to unpack those effects if you try to interrogate the saving behavior of the particular society in which you live in. So finally, in a world, we need to do it as a language through which identities are often displayed and understood. Then those ones and constraints may symbolize aspirations for freedom from the power relationship that oppress in our daily struggle, including gender, race, class, sexuality. Sometimes people say, I want to do what they think, I want to buy something because I want to liberate myself. So sometimes society we live in, those moments of change that we find very hard and sustained hopes of liberation, regardless of how unrealistic that is. Somebody gets very angry and takes a credit card and goes to the ATM machine and goes to bar. So I'm just saying that those psychological aspects of our behavior is just as important as the cognitive aspect of our saving behavior. And this is in fact what Milton Keynes referred to when he talked about marginal propensity to kill. He didn't talk about interest rate, he talked about fundamental psychological barrier. And so it's very important that we interrogate saving and saving to look at homo economicus, which is this super hyper rational individual that makes all the computations, and what are the homo psychologicus, which is derived from our environment and our history. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Melvin, and all professors, very illuminating presentation you had. I feel like you've been in a very vibrant economic class with this you must actually ask for a video of his inaugural lecture where he was talking about a broken limo. Still remember it. We take 10 minutes and grab some caffeine, and those that take decaf are also welcome, and then we'll come back and just have a discussion on both. Okay.
I'm
staying for the rest of the evening.
No. I've got another meeting. Trying to finish it before it stops.
No, I don't. Thank you very much. Thank you. I didn't go to Thank you.
The other presenter was Mr.
Jukasi and Anyoka.
Ayugo.
In Europe.
Yeah. Yeah, Mr. Melvin Ayugo.
Yes, I've got his card too, thank you.
Okay.
good afternoon and welcome back. I must say we tried very hard to see whether we couldn't start a little earlier in order to finish early. But seems like all odds were against us. But here we are with the Office of the Bank Supervision to take the presentation on the annual report. We have a team of two. Aaron Kruger, who is the Executive Manager of Registrar Bank, the Reserve Bank, and Mr. Eugene Faith, who is the Senior Analyst in the Central Bank, are going to be presenting to us. It is quite a voluminous presentation, as members may have seen. My humble appeal would be that if we care, we try and cut it to the bone so that we allow more time for engagement than the presentation itself. I don't know, you'll use your skills to make sure that we stay attentive to the presentation and also things which would be the salient features that you wouldn't want us to miss. These are members of parliament, someone with sensitized to the fact that you are not bankers, you're members of parliament. That's on page 15 of the presentation.
Trading information on the South African bank sector and some trends taking place there. Just again to reiterate my permission department, or rather my permission of the department is, and that is namely to promote the soundness of the banking system through the effective and efficient application of international regulatory and supervisory standards. And obviously we execute our function in terms of the Bank Act 1990. Developments and activities in banking supervision which have taken place over the past year, which have been elucidated upon in the report. Essentially the core principles for effective banking supervision from the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. We will get into each one of these in a bit more detail. The development of banking directors insofar as ensuring a standardized format for that. The Basel II issue or the new capital accord, as that is quite commonly referred to, anti-money laundering legislation and compliance agreements, the implementation of that by the bank, international supervisory interaction, home host issues between ourselves and those areas where our banks are internationally active and other international banks are active in South Africa. A little bit on the proliferation of credit in South Africa. The combating of illegal deposit taking, i.e. those people who accept deposits from the public who are not related to the bank. And then some detail on the training of the staff that need to execute these functions and present some general issues. The four principles for effective banking supervision comprise 25 fundamental requirements which cover various components and aspects of the bank supervisory system that need to be complied with for banking supervisors to operate effectively and for banks to operate in a sound and efficient manner. The core principles were published by the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision in 1997 with an assessment methodology which was then published in 1999. As I said, this was developed by the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision at the request of the G7 finance ministers at that point in time and was developed through close association with supervisors across the world. And the IMF and the World Bank to monitor the implementation of the core copy service by core principles, and that forms the basis for what's known as the Financial Sector Assessment Program, i.e. when the IMF and the World Bank to and from performance systems of countries insofar as the financial system is concerned and specifically the banking system, in terms of the regulation of the banking system, they would accept compliance with the core principles. The uniqueness of the core principles is that it was adopted for the first time in non-G10 countries to be part of the working group, and South Africa is part of that. It was originally tasked to discuss and oversee the application of the core principles at the International Liaison Group. It has developed into a high-level forum, the Basel Committee liaison with senior non-G10 supervisors, the IMF and the World Bank. The objectives of the principle is to ensure that the provision of sufficient powers and independence and resources for supervisory authorities around the globe, the provision of a roadmap for sound supervisory framework, the strengthening of the legal framework, because obviously one needs to have a strong legal framework in place, and then obviously the governance aspects that are prescribed therein and for appropriate checks and balances, which are needed for the supervisory authorities to conduct their business. The four principles do not provide an instant magic potion for countries with inexperienced supervisors. It's not a substitute for financial mismanagement. It doesn't reduce the responsibility of the supervisory authorities, and importantly, it's not a guarantee that no bank will fail. These core principles were revised as a result of significant developments having taken place since 1997 when they were first established. And the three key areas where the revision took place were in the enhancement of risk management, in corporate governance issues, and in anti-money laundering and anti-terrorist financing concerns. And those are the three key areas where the core principles had to be revised and did need to be chalked up in terms of best international practice. Also, there were lessons from the ESCAP which had taken place subsequent to the introduction in 1997, and more precision was required with respect to certain issues. But as we said, the idea was not to change the goalposts, but more to keep it aligned with what current practice was. There was a reference group which was established to do this task, and it was finalized in October last year when the Basel Committee announced the final document, which was then the new Basel IV principles, or the revised IV principles, to which countries would need to subscribe to. The Bank Supervision Department did perform a self-assessment during the course of last year in order to ensure what our how we would benchmark and de-benchmark against the revised core principles ahead of any review which may take place by the International Monetary Fund. We conducted a comprehensive gap analysis and then developed our action plan to eliminate any identified shortcomings that may have come out of that. The project commenced during the first half of 2006 and is actually nearing completion as we talk at the moment. Quite a voluminous part of the project that community has been done. I think importantly is the second bullet on the slide that a conservative approach was adopted in our own self-assessment. In essence, if in any one of the 25 principles, which was a number of supporting essential criteria and additional criteria, if there was any one of those criteria in terms of which we were non-compliant, we marked ourselves non-compliant in respect of the total core principle itself. This culminated in the workshop, which was attended by all of our staff, and our project team, as I said, is now in the final home straight, the implementation of revised activity within our department to ensure that we have we found that beginning we were about 72% compliant, that has been gone up to about 80% as we speak, and when the bank's amendment bill, which is scheduled for implementation 1 January 2008, the number of the issues which are in that bank's amendment bill will then ensure we comply with the principle. Another important area was the development of bank directors during the year under review. I think it's common knowledge that ultimately it's directors which need to drive the direction and take responsibility for the activities of the banking institution. And we continue to focus on the corporate governance processes during 2006, and specifically the induction and training program these banks have in place for the appointment of the new direction. We've seen that these programs did diverge significantly from institution to institution. And as we said, bank operations are unique. However, the director should be prepared for a homogeneous development program, at least they have the real start from the same page. We communicated this divergence to the Banking Association of South Africa that there were no bank-specific development programs which are available. The Banking Association, in turn, on behalf of the industry, requested the University of Pretoria through one of its management schools to develop a direct investment program, which was developed during the latter part of last year, consisting of an introductory course for directors, a governance level risk management course, as well as a leadership forum where focus can be on real life experiences that have taken place. This program satisfies the need for new and experienced directors and provides that in a modular type approach, and that many of the directors who have been directors for a number of years can attend certain of the modules should they find that the most recent developments in terms of product innovation, etc., need some exposition to themselves. It's a comprehensive program which provides solid foundation for the new directors entering the banking sector, and bank chairpersons have been encouraged to utilize the program. And obviously the development program which the banks themselves have is supplementing to the standard director program which has been entered into. So that is ongoing. The third courses have been held this year, and I think there will be a second session in the third quarter of this year as we speak. The new capital accord, namely Basel II, which as a quick introduction, is really the capital management part of banking, and this will be implemented by South Africa and by South African banks on 1 January 2008, and it is the efficient management of capital which is essential for stability of the banking system and for the individual bank to make up that banking system. The Accord Implementation Forum is something which continues to develop and do a lot of work last year. The attendees or all the members of the AIF was obviously the South African Reserve Bank in its most widest sense, not only from the bank's division department, but also from the research department, from the financial stability department. All the commercial banks, the National Treasury, South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, and the Banking Association. All stakeholders intensified efforts during the year under review, and the proposed regulations which were issued in November 2006 have been issued back from the industry with their comments, and that has been worked on as we speak. The main issue is that Basel II now offers a menu of approaches for the calculation of capital, whereas Basel I did not allow for different approaches. Specifically insofar as credit risk and operational risk is concerned, there are a number of different menu approaches that are available to banks, and for the first time, banks will be required to hold capital against operational risk. Advanced approaches are something which banks would need to apply for approval for the utilization thereof to ensure that they have the adequate systems in place for the implementation of that. And those will probably be considered during the course of this year. As I've mentioned, there are a menu of approaches, and just a quick overview that we can see in terms of the locally registered banks, that 14 banks will be on book in terms of the standardized approach. And then the foundation internal ratings-based approach, which is where banks' internal models are used for, and there will be one, and then four in the advanced internal ratings-based approach. And then similarly for the branches of international banks 11 and 3. I think the approaches for operational risk, which I won't get into, but again, an indicator there that between the basic indicator approach and the standardized approach, one sees the majority of banks, who are the banks there. So for the year under review, significant progress was made with the project. Supervisors around the world are facing challenges in ensuring effective and appropriate implementation of this. And I think in the words of the chair of the Basel Committee, that supervisors have utilized supervisory tools in the past, which fortunately will still be relevant to Basel III implementation, such as the adjustment in GP1C. The next area, which was the compliance with the Financial Intelligence Center Act, and the important development which took place there, and really, I think, finalized the effects of compliance. There was a review performed of compliance with the FIC Act, the Financial Intelligence Center Act. The largest five banks were reviewed during 2005, and what the issues were that came out of that was then actually worked upon by those banks, and further follow-up actions were then taken during the course of 2006, specifically at board level, at risk committee level, and at audit committee level, and internal audit level, to ensure that compliance is in place. And a similar review of the remaining local banks under which those other than the last five were conducted during 2006 in selected branches of foreign banks, and for the larger branches of foreign banks, one farm that is the internal audit divisions from their head offices that come to South Africa to perform an internal audit of their operations to ensure that they do comply with the Financial Action Task Force prescriptions. All banks have made significant progress in implementing these anti-money laundering measures and counter-terrorist financing measures, and the role of the internal audit within the organization has been significantly extended to include compliance checks with the requirements. In terms of international supervisory action, I think it's suffice to say that the department continued to interact with those areas where host issues are concerned. So the dialogue between the supervisors where our banks would be active on a global basis and where international banks would actually be in our country did continue, and also in terms of Basel Committee work and IMF work, there was close cooperation to ensure that we remain at the cutting edge of the developments which are taking place on a global basis and which impact on our banking system. The proliferation of credit in South Africa, which was one of the changes which we also proposed in the Bank Amendment Law, is that there was a situation developing where at times maybe the public was being exposed to new names which were not necessarily banks, but yet into banking services, which was slightly confusing. Suffice to say that these joint ventures or divisions of banks are not standalone initiatives, and that they do operate as a division of banks, and that from the department's perspective, we ensure that prudent risk management of the joint venture is undertaken and they operate within the division of those banks. Legal deposit taking is something which has continued together with us over the past year. While one is not responsible for registering or supervising investment schemes, we do have power to control the activities of unregistered persons who conduct the business of banking. The business of banking is defined as the taking of deposits from the public. Approximately 40 of these unregistered businesses or investment schemes were investigated during 2006. Not that 40 arose during 2006, but a number of them have arisen from the past 2 years. And as we roll over from one year to the next, they can hand it over for prosecution, etc. But there were quite a number of those schemes which still discussed. And I think an important issue which we found last year was that these schemes are becoming more professional, if I could use that word, in terms of their business, in the sense that it's not anymore merely pertaining to the training of our staff, just to say that in terms of the IMS training initiatives which are provided, we have participated in those, ongoing Basel II training, as well as the Financial Stability Institute in Switzerland, who is going to help a lot with our type of training that we need. And also we hosted intermediate courses for the SADC countries in South Africa. So it was not only that we were receiving training, but we were also giving training during the year under review. And then also with the SSA in the UK, we have a close working relationship with you also, the sister. So the one important area which I would like to mention is which is in the second bullet, is the SSI Connect, which is a web-based training system which has been by the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland, which is the most up-to-date training detail which one can have from a banking perspective, and the South African Reserve Bank subscribes for licensing for inside apartments so that every person can have access to that information. We also attended the ICBS International Conference of Banking Supervisors. We had market risk and liquidity risk management, joint initiatives with South African Bank, consolidated supervision, which is the joint forum working stream from the financial conglomerate, the implementation of the audit and protection act of success. I think these are all issues which impacted in one way or another on ourselves. So I think those were, in short, a number of the activities which were on our table during the year under review. What is the banking system during the year has proceeded in terms of legislation? We continue to ensure that our legal framework remains relevant and current. We review the banking legislation on a regular basis and incorporate the two important issues for this year under review was the Basel II amendments as well as the security provision, which have been included in the relevant bank acquisition. The law itself has been through a consultation process with the AIF, Planning Committee for the Bank Act, as well as ministerial approval, for the two by cabinet, and has been presented to this committee as well, and will go through a second reading on the 23rd of August this year. The regulations which will need to be issued in terms of those proposed amendments will be tabled for consideration and approval to the Minister of Finance towards the end of August for them to consider and then for implementation going through to the 1st of January next year. We turn to some study of information on the banking system itself. As of May, the banking system consists of 20 registered banks, 2 registered mutual banks and 14 registered local branches of foreign banks. So those 76 entities were the deposit-taking entities in South Africa, with the 43 representative offices of foreign banks being offices in South Africa who, whilst they are representatives of foreign banks, chose not to accept deposits in South Africa. So they are exactly what they were doing. They represent the head office of don't accept deposits in South Africa. The snapshot of the information for the banking sector as of December 2006, which is in the middle column, speaks for itself. For the first time, the global assets exceeded 2 trillion rand year on year. By May, that had gone up to 2.2. And I think all the ratios were moving in the right direction, but probably the one to take note of are the non-performing loans, which is the third from the bottom, which whilst has improved in total from December 05 to December 06, from 20.1 billion down to 18.8, one can see that subsequent to the year end, that has again increased back up to 22 billion in terms of those overviews. The ratio, fairly stable, 1.1, 1.2, and then I think importantly that the capital adequacy ratio has stayed fairly stable around about the 12.3, 12.4 million. Efficiency ratio, which is really the ratio of snapshot of the distribution of sectors. So you can see in the order of size, the first sector being 2.2, which is over 2 trillion rand, and a second order of which banks are the largest. Standard Bank is 550, and then down to C79 for Net Bank, and then C for Investing, with the demonstration of the other 2.4 trillion rand. Number 10, in the balance sheet structure, this is the balance sheet structure for the year. I think one can see fairly strong growth. The gold bar shows that the total aggregated balance sheet was about 2 billion rand at the end of the year, up from 1.6 billion rand in the prior year. And on the red line, one can see the extent change in the growth, which has come down slightly in the last quarter, last year down to about 25%. The composition of the liabilities of the balance sheet, the largest proportion, about 65% of that, being non-bank deposits. In other words, what one is referring to there are those deposits with banks which have come from generally from the public and from corporations, from companies, etc. In other words, not into banks. And that's the largest portion, 65%, and then we will have to do the breakdown of that. So of the total of the 1.3 billion of the non-bank deposits, one has a breakdown on this slide of really what are the terms of those deposits. And one can see that in the main it's basically the same year on year, with the largest portion being in the demand column, in the demand part of the pie chart, with negotiable certificates of deposit being those ones which are slightly increased. And that will be due to the interest curve, which has changed over the last period, which has made that product more attractive. Just very drastically to fix the composition of those non-bank deposits, about 1.3 billion rand, and one can see that about 67% of that is in the short term, i.e. shorter than 31 days, and then in the medium term, about 20%, and then 13% in the longer term. Turning to the asset side of the balance sheet of the industry, total assets, just over 2 trillion rand. Again, non-bank loans and advances. So loans and advances to that part of the economy which are not banked, about 1.5 billion rand. So one can see that constitutes about 76% of the 2 trillion rand, with about 4.5% being in the interbank market. So that's of the total loans and advances, total loans and advances are about 1.7 trillion of the total assets of 2 trillion. And one can see how those assets, all those loans and advances are, have grown during the course of the year. A steady increase in the gold bar. And on the blue line is the percentage change. And again, one sees that slight decrease coming through towards the end of the last quarter. Just a split of what the loans and advances consist of, and one can see that in terms of the split, about 681 billion rand is in restricted mortgage loans, which represents close on 40% of the total loans and advances. And similarly, overdrafting loans is about 22%, which represents about 384 billion rand. So those are the two main components of the loans and advances, one is on the 7 trillion rand. So the rest being made up of installment debt is about 207 billion rand and then 210 billion rand in foreign loans. But in the main, it's the mortgage loan book and the overdraft loan, which collectively constitutes close on 50% of those loans in advance. Capital adequacy. The capital adequacy ratio, in other words, the extent of capital which is held as a percentage of the risk-weighted assets of the industry. The minimum requirement is 10%, and we can see that South African banks are around about the 12.3% level. It goes up and down as asset growth takes place. It's been quite an extensive capital raising exercise that has taken place during the year under review, and the downward training in Greenland is not in any way interpreted as capital benefit. It's working, but it's really the absorption of excess capital in terms of the assets which have been put on the books. That's what I'm saying. In terms of the various categories of banks, in terms of capital adequacy, one can just see what percentage of banks are in which category. So those which should be between 10 and 12%, that represents a total of 25%, and we see that those with more than 20% capital adequacy ratio of 39%. I think the gold bar just shows what percentage of banks are in which category, and the unknown bottom left in the category less than 10%. And here is where one can actually see how the qualifying capital has increased during the period under review. Primary capital being on the blue bar, secondary capital just being like the bench, etc., on the gray bar, and then the qualifying capital reserve in the green line, which is above the red line, which is the regulatory minimum of 10%. The risk profile is really to show the assets in terms of what the risk weightings are that I've shown earlier, and it's around about 65%. In terms of profitability for the industry, one just concentrates on the very large bar in December, one gets an indication of what components make up the income of banks. And one can see that the interest margin does make up quite a substantial portion, together with transaction-based fee income, and then a pretty small piece from the technology-based fee income, the investment income then being the large part on the top. So those are the four different components that make up the income statement, with the interest margin and transaction-based fee income being the two main components. And that interest margin is around 3.4% for the year at the end of the year. And one can see how that can move up and down as the United States has between interest rate changes and that's great. The growth in staff expenses, number of employees and the number of branches of the bank. One can see that staff expenses grew by about 15% year on year. Number of employees increased by 12.6%. With the number of branches having increased by about 8.5%. So one sees quite a higher level of activity in staff being employed as well as branches being open as the economy has been quite buoyant during the past period. The efficiency ratio of the banking sector, as I mentioned earlier, which is the cost to income ratio. So one could see that a downturn in this ratio is positive. The lower this ratio, the better. And while expenses have been fairly stable for the year under review, the income has increased quite considerably, which has led to the improved ratio of around about the 56-57% level. So that's a positive impact for our bank. And then really just to say that in terms of the various banks' sizes, one can see what the efficiency ratio of those banking institutions are according to their asset value. So those which have asset greater than 50 billion, 94 ratio, those greater than 10 billion, 459, greater than 5 billion, 56, greater than 1 billion, 74, and so on. I think the main message is that the efficiency ratio has improved. Profitability in terms of ROE and ROA, in other words, return on equity and return on assets. If you look at the return on equity for the banking system, that is, it has increased quite well over the year on year, and the return on assets as well. You see around about the 13% level, which is under the 1.4% level respectively. But an increasing trend, which is exactly which is in line with the profitability sector that we saw. One may have actually seen that line even going up slightly higher if there hadn't been as much additional capital that was issued during the year. In terms of liquidity risk, one could be at the statutory liquid assets this bank are required to hold. Banks need to hold liquid assets based on the liability structure, and the requirement is depicted on the red or maybe the maroon bar. We want to see that that's around about the 70 billion rand level, and we see on the gold bar that banks have been holding in excess of that. So the liquid assets as a percentage is more than 100%, thus reflecting that there is liquidity and sufficient liquidity in the system. The 10 largest depositors from banks, which is about 390 billion rand, as a percentage of the total funding of about 1.7 billion, 1.7 trillion dollars. One can see there that in total it's about 22%, which is below the 25% aggregated level, which is a requirement in terms of the regulations. And then the breakdown, 5 to 7 days, and then the longer than 7 days, i.e. 80 to 31 days, about 8.5%. But generally, in good levels there. And then the anticipated maturity of the short-term funding. Really what one is looking at is some of the anticipated maturity, which is significantly different from contractual maturity. I mean, those deposits in the 0 to 31 day time band, which are contractually set to mature, but the behavior of the client has indicated the pattern that they are not withdrawn, and in fact those deposits are rolled over on a month-to-month basis, and about 80% of those deposits in the 0 to 31 days are rolled over, with only about 20% being withdrawn on maturity. It is a hard call, a portion of the deposit which remains. And I think the similarity in the bank is those are sticky deposits in the bank. Derivative contracts. Total turnover in those derivative contracts, about 2.6 trillion rand at the end of the year. And one can see the forward contracts which have been executed, and then also they've been charted on the red bar. So obviously forward contracts, forward exchange contracts in the foreign exchange market form quite a lot of part of that. But in the essence, on the blue bar, fairly stable type of turnover which has taken place in those particular markets. And then in terms of the unexpired derivative contracts, about 1.2 trillion rand, slightly picked up from the year onwards, but also fairly stable so far as that has taken place. The more important area one would like to believe is our credit risk. As we said, the total bank sector overdue is about 18.8 billion rand at year end. Subsequent to year end, as we saw in the beginning, that has moved up to 22 billion rand. This is a snapshot of the trend. One can see that trend having come down from the beginning of 2004 all the way through to the end of the year. If we look at the next slide, which is the net overdue, i.e. provision has now been made for security as well as for the provisions which have been raised, one sees that the net overdue is of about 8.5 billion rand, and that is a percentage of the net qualifying capital reserves. About 5.6% net capital and qualifying reserves, about 152 billion rand. The composition of those overdues, as we said, the total overdues, 18.8 billion rand. And if we look at the various books as a percentage of each box, so what one is saying on the red line, the total mortgages overdue as a percentage of total home loan book, it was about 1.2-1.3%. Similarly, for the other loans and advances, which is typically the overdraft, etc., about the same amount. And then on installment, one sees that has gone up quite a bit at under 2% level. So those are the percentages of the book which are in the overdue column. If we look at what the absolute numbers are, and I think probably these are ones which are more important than ratios, because ratios can tend to mark the actual position, but as the denominator grows, the percentage gets stable and it will be stable. So looking at the actual numbers, if we look at the mortgage book, we can see that from the end of December 2005, there was 6.1 billion rand worth of had increased as at the end of December 66.9 million. I wonder if that's a trend there. That mortgage number at the moment, that probably used to be sitting close to the 9 billion rand mark, so it's not much significant difference. The instalment book stayed relatively stable for the year under review, but again has also risen to over 4 billion as we speak. And then the other loans in advance, really overdraft and loans, etc., that came down, but one would suspect that that was given away to the mortgage book. So in fact, one may have found that consumers were funding for mortgage expenditure via access to the home loan. So one does see the start of some credit stress beginning to show through in terms of these numbers over here. Whilst there is some indicator of overdue having increased, the coverage ratio, i.e. the security and the provision that are held, do reflect that the overdue portions are covered to a sufficient amount of 100%, so that would be covered. Large exposures, which have been granted as a percentage of net qualifying capital reserves, and those large exposures, about 511 billion, and if the utilized portion of that is only 266 billion rand, and one can see that large exposure grant has reduced over time, that's coming down, and utilization stays pretty stable. In terms of asset performance, one can see that total 80% of the industry has a reasonable return on the assets that they have on their books. The last area is currency risk, and the maximum net effect of open position in foreign currency as a percentage of total qualified capital reserves. The statutory limit should be 10%, and we can see that the banking sector is well within the 10% limit. I think 3% was the highest that it had been. And then similarly, in terms of the forward position, one can see the physical and the net forward position really is a 12,000 to quite a small position, which then translates into an open position against the net qualifying capital reserve. So I think those are in check. The chair, at your request, that was rather fast for the move through, but I think that's what you've asked for. Thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, very well done. I had anticipated that by now you would have got this far. And I thought that members had read the report, because they had the report well in advance. And if there are any questions, now we would come from members now. Mr. Mulaka, Mr. Gibson. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank
you.
Now, there are a lot of questions.
I'm not sure that you take three and then wait for the next.
You know,
because I'm seeing that you're the 2 o'clock.
For now, yeah. And let's take the brief and we'll see how it goes. Go ahead. Don't push it too hard.
No, I'm
trying to
do it. My first question is, why do you require banks? I understand because of some regulatory measures that you are going to put in place to manage it. I don't want to find out why you require banks to report the 10 measures before sales on their balance sheet. Second question would be, what the fee income and the investment and trading income? I don't want to find out in particular reference to the fee income. Is the fee income the one that normal consumers are complaining about? The transaction cost, is that the other one? I'm not sure. And my third question, around our balance sheet activity, I just want to find out what items are allowed by the banking supervision to be kept off balance sheet. I can take the rest after six more.
When will we check? But let me also just, you know, we've actually been sitting with Mr. Fontana at the back there. So director of financial stability. And you're welcome. I apologize for having not recognized you earlier. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chairperson. A few questions. The first one relates to money laundering. You mentioned that it's one of your functions, of course. And I'm asking if you know how many matters have been referred to Peter by that, and how many prosecutions have there been, and how many convictions have there been. Peter seems to indicate that they know these figures, so I'm hoping that you know, because if you don't know them, how can you know whether the legislation is happening and whether the bank can't? The second one, why do banks all increase their lending rates as the Reserve Bank increases its rate? We know that the banks don't all borrow their money at that interest rate. They get it from all sorts of sources and overseas and so on. Why isn't there some competition? And is there anything that we could do or should do to try to see that the banks that operate as in fact as a cartel? The third question might be because of my ignorance. You mentioned here that the regulations showing from Basel II, draft 4 would be before the committee in the first quarter of 2007, and it'll be sent to the Minister for approval. I've only been on this committee for a short while. Did that happen? And where are these regulations now? And then if I could just do the final one, if I may.
Your third one. Was there another one, Mr. Akira?
Chair, for the first time, I'll piggyback on the honorable member to have a question. I don't know whether he was able to carry it. Chair, I want to ask whether if the bank are raising when you are raising it, and we, the public there, is carrying the flag, you can have the person who is banking, it is easy for the money to carry the flag if there is a hyper on interest rate. Then, to whom does that money go to? Does it go to the bank owners or what is it? And what kind of relation with that money? Because to me, as a lay person, that is a lot of money that they make. In respect to the rate they are lending money. So I want to understand if you can clarify it.
Question one.
Thank you. The minimum fiscal requirements that the requires by the bank of credit if it increases, what impact does it have on the borrowing requirements or on the impact it has on the poor when they want to borrow money? And also on the liquidity. Why on the requirements? Because I think what happens is the bank system doesn't need the liquidity. There must be liquidity as a result of the requirements. Why don't you insist on the requirement if they are expensive for them and not the concept that you can avoid those because you don't have the time? And that's just for my increasingness. Yeah. After I've been taken over already in the Army Protection with the Vikings and now the social mid-bank is the first speaker banking institution from the Vikings that they've been taking over already. The federal share with mid-bank. I'm going to find out if I'm not here for any bank for the same bank. and what you get imported by capitalism.
Let's respond to those and then we'll take the next question.
Thank you, Chief. I'll take them in order as they came. On the 10 largest depositors, the reason why there is emphasis on that is in terms of concentration risk. And by that one means that if one has too large a proportion of the deposits of two smaller amounts of people or depositors, and thus depositors want their money back, it can cause a liquidity crunch for a bank. So one would not want to have the 10 largest depositors constituting more than collectively 25% of the total deposits. It should they want to, or should they then at any stage collectively start to withdraw to get a liquidity crunch? And not only that on one bank, but if it's similarly with the entire system, 1% of the system, which would be under a severe liquidity crunch and stress. And this is something which is applied globally to all banks in terms of liquidity risk management, to always ensure that there's not a concentration risk of exposure to individual deposits.
Thank you, but you've got less pleasure for.
The regulations,
Chair.
In terms of fee income and transaction-based income are the income which emanates from the transactions which we undertake with our bank. So the fees which are levied in terms of our deposits, our withdrawals, checks we may write out, internet banking, etc. Whereas fee income is based more on advisory services which banks may typically offer should they be advising on, for example, a merger and an acquisition. So in corporate structures, in merchant banking structures, that's the difference there. In terms of off-balance sheet activity, it's something which you, I think, are quite correct. I think that's one doesn't want to have too much activity off the balance sheet because that's the inherent risk in terms of capturing that risk and actually managing that risk. But as a typical example for off-balance sheet activity would be guaranteed with bank issues. So a client may wish to purchase a home that transaction will only be completed in 2 or 3 months' time with the registration of the mortgage bond. But obviously the seller would want certainty that the purchaser has bought that home, and for that reason the purchaser would approach his or her bank, and that bank would issue a guarantee on behalf of that purchaser to say, as and when the transaction is completed, we confirm as the bank that we will make those loans available. So it's a contingent liability, it's off the balance sheet, and it is recorded as such, and then when the transaction is consummated, so when, for example, the mortgage bond has been registered, and the bank in fact pays the money out, and the seller receives the money, and the purchaser is now the owner of the property, that would then become an advance on the books of the bank. That would be reflected in the bank book as an advance to person A, and that would be on balance sheet, and then the repayment terms would start from then on. In terms of anti-money laundering, the suspicious transaction reports are referred to the Financial Intelligence Center and not to ourselves. So the supervisory role which we perform is to ensure that there are proper processes and procedures in place for the institutions to identify suspicious transactions, that they have proper processes and systems in place to correctly identify their clients, the known customer rules, etc. But the actual reporting of those suspicious transactions are passed through to the Financial Intelligence Center. And in fact, there are there, there is that the teacher is cutting off. And anybody that's involved in cutting off would be considered to be actually part of the transaction under surveillance. So there may very well be activities which have been reported, which would only, that actual knowledge would be between the bank that has reported it, as well as between the financial intelligence center. So I don't think it provides the numbers that the Honourable Minister is looking for, but as I said, you would not have the suspicious transaction report with yourself. The issue of why banks increase rates when the repo rate goes up has been a topic which the governor has been quite interested in of late. I think one may have seen some comments which he's made on that over the past couple of months. And it's certainly something that is slightly out of the field of bank supervision, and also for quite a good reason. It's really monetary policy. And before within that ambit, and if supervision and monetary policy start getting entwined with each other, there could be some conflicts of interest. But certainly the understanding that one has of it is that in terms of the repo or the repurchase agreement system that's in place, I think the policy is coming to the central bank. I think later this month, maybe early next month, I'm not sure. It would be quite a good idea to have our financial markets division, who would very typically administer the repurchase system, quite clearly explain how that works and where interest rates and etc. should be something which does fall outside of our. Draft 4 of the regulation, which I mentioned, I can maybe be a little more specific and apologize if I wasn't in the initial presentation. And that was what was crafted last year. And these are regulations which get drafted in terms of the Bank Amendment Bill. So in terms of the Bank Act, the Minister of Finance issued the regulations, and they do not come to this committee, but the Act comes, or the Act amendments come to this committee. So draft 5 has been in the process of being revised, and that will be presented to the Minister once the bill has been approved, the Bank Act amendment. And there's been a number of these drafts, so this will run 2, 3, and 4, which have taken place. Just to touch on again the issues surrounding if rates increase, where does the money go? I think the issue there is that rates would always rise on both the assets and the liabilities. And we mentioned earlier in the presentation what was called the interest margin. In other words, the difference between the rate charged and the rate received. So very typically, one would find that when rates increase, it increases on both sides of the balance sheet. So on the liability, which are the deposits, banks would be paying more for the money that they need to fund themselves with. So the cash that they then would deposit that they have would be an increased amount that they would have to pay. And on the loans that they've made, that also after the rates would go up. So the net effect for the actual bank itself is that it would be only the interest margin which would probably stay fairly stable. So it's not as if the increase in the rate means that somebody else can put the money going to one lucky person, or the whole person where it goes to. The minimum capital requirement, if I want to elaborate on that a little bit and the impact of that, capital is not something which is of a short-term nature, but it's more of a long-term nature. So cost of capital is something it's not a direct cost, and it's not passed on in the first instance to the public. People would invest in organizations, people, whether they be institutional investors, or asset managers, whoever, would invest in an organization based on their expectation of what the soundness of the organization is and what the return on capital would be, as opposed to the deposit of the organization. So the issue of capital is that it's an investment over a long term, and the capital in turn is used to gear the balance sheet, i.e. for every 1 or 2 rand worth of capital which the bank has, it uses that in turn to raise further deposits, and the deposits that are used to then fund the growth in the balance sheet going forward. I think your next question, I remember, was on the Absa Barclays and the Nedbank and the charters, and I can report that certainly there's been no approach to our office on this. It's only a rumour, and I have confirmed with both institutions that what was in the press was incorrect. So there have been no approach to us. And if one saw that the movement in the various underlying share prices returned to where the levels were before the movement took place. So definitely not an issue which is on our table. And I think it's also important to note that even when or if such an issue would come onto our table with any of the banks, whilst in terms of the Banks Act, that is an issue which the registrar needs to make a recommendation to the Minister of Finance on, should the investment be greater than 49%. It's certainly not an issue which is handled in isolation. I think you're quite correct by saying that there are national issues that are at stake. There are macroeconomic issues which are at stake, and there are also regulatory issues at stake. So it's not only a regulatory issue that would need to be considered.
As long as you don't have history, you can ask all of us. Firstly, there will be your relationship with the financial trading board. What type of working arrangement do you have to avoid a situation where there's a double counting of funds by those you remunerate? Because we all know that the banks are involved in the insurance industry also. So how do you ascertain that the capital of the key is not our concept? Second question would be, how do you regulate the activities of South African banks outside, within South Africa, you just say that you have got South African banks operating in the Sukuk, probably the Sukuk, I don't know, Swaziland, some might be in the Sukuk. How do you ensure that they are properly regulated? I don't know what type of working arrangements we have with those regulators, because you only mentioned Namibia. So I'm not sure whether you have also a working arrangement with the rest. My last question here, actually, after you know, which I'll ask the next one. My last question is, the legislation that we passed, I can't remember, could be 3 or 4 years ago, from the Banks Amendment Act. And part of the stipulations within that legislation was that banks have to retain their auditors. I'm not sure whether it was as long as I've read that legislation. I just want to find out whether that's being done. That's it.
One question is concerning all over the world about the American situation with subprime lending. It seems to be clear, as you have confirmed from your report, that we face no such possible crisis at all, because the amount of the non-performing loan are well within the percentage. And I was wondering whether the percentage amounts to 20%, whether that is in fact having.
I'm not too sure whether you give it this issue, but I would like to know your view of your information, but I now this is my goal on the securitization of the mortgages. Second stage, the governor said he said that the bank can securitize their loans in order to kill their books. Now, in my view, is that a lot of people that have mortgages both the bank for bonds and to buy their houses, and they said the bank securitized them. What impact does this have on the overall debt? The expression of debt how is it when we securitize our loan? And how does this impact on your life to ensure that you have a more than a share of the debt comes from the loan? And then another issue is on the Mzansi account. Mzansi account. The banks are making a series from the financial fees they charge on the people that see their minimum transactions on the Mzansi account. Do you also provide that? I don't know if you to provide pensions, but you look into that issue because Mzansi account is very popular and banks be very good at all. But the banks are making a series on the The first question was what the relationship with the Financial Services Board with respect to the double counting of capital. That is a very real issue which one needs to ensure that not happens. And for that purpose, there is the principle of what's termed consolidated supervision. In terms of consolidated supervision, there would be an agreement as to who the lead regulator of a particular group would be, either the banking regulator or the insurance regulator. We have a quarterly meeting with the Financial Services Board in terms of a memorandum of understanding which we have together with the SSB, where the various consolidated groups which both of us have an interest are presented from both sides in terms of consolidated supervision, and we would regulate up to a bank controlling company, and the SSB would insurance side of things, and through the calculation of that capital on a consolidated basis, obviously those capital numbers would then net each other out, and there is a calculation on a quarterly basis to ensure that the group is adequately capitalized. So those discussions take place formally on a quarterly basis, and then on an operational basis, both institutions have people who are working on the day-to-day supervision of those entities, and they are in touch with each other on a regular basis. So I think
activation methodology, which are in the regulation, take account for that type of potentiality. In respect of banks in credit, the issue of home post regulatory cooperation comes to the fore. And in the main, how one would really ensure that that the bank is doing what it should be doing and that's doing good, that's not doing what it shouldn't be doing, is that one relies on the host supervisor. So, for example, in Swazi Land, we have regular contact with our counterparts. They've been to South Africa this year, and we do meet with them, and they would inform us should there be anything that comes to their attention if they believe that us as home authority needs to address as regards the behavior or otherwise of a particular bank in that jurisdiction. Similarly, we have banks in South Africa that we host, and they emanate from another jurisdiction. We rely on that home jurisdiction for them to be the authority which will perform the overall supervision of the group, but they in turn rely on us to inform them if in South Africa there are issues occurring with their bank that we picked up that we need to alert them to. And I think this is quite a key issue which comes out of the Basel Core Principles document, which says that the supervisors cannot be all over at the same time, but that there should be the proper framework which enables business to still be a global business, but at the same time they have proper cooperation and proper similar standards around the various jurisdictions to ensure that communication at an early stage is effective from the host to the home. Similarly, if there's something in a home country, just as an example, if there's a problem with a South African bank in South Africa, and it's of such a nature that it could affect or have an effect in a country where that bank, the South African bank, also has representation, then it is incumbent upon us to engage with the supervisory authority in that country at an early stage to alert them that there is a problem that needs to be handled. So it's really all about home host issues, and as I said, there's a vast array of standards and principles in terms of the four principles, also in terms of the new Basel II requirements that require that supervisors perform effective home host coordination activities. I think your third item was the rotation of auditors. And quite correct, that was part. It has been implemented. It's no longer an event, it's the normal standard now, and we've been through the third cycle of auditors having been rotated, and in fact we've had very positive feedback from the auditing profession itself that notwithstanding and maybe despite the initial apprehension to this, they found that it actually served them quite well in the sense that they have a fresh pair of eyes looking at different audits now. And they felt that it's actually been beneficial to them from a perspective that they are they're not at risk in the sense that they have new partners on different jobs who would maybe see things which a second pair of eyes may not have picked up after 4 or 5 years. So that is on the definitely on the boat. I'd like to deal with the subprime issue and securitization at once, and I think the two are quite interlinked. Certainly the issue with subprime is on the one hand the packaging of loans and then the selling off of these loans, which is very similar to what the securitization issue is. So firstly to say that the extent of securitization in South Africa, which is fairly new compared to what's been happening across the world, is a number, and forgive me, I think the absolute number, I think it was around about 1.5 billion, 2 billion rand worth, is really very, very small. also the funding for that, suicide vehicle should you not be coming back from the bank again for the winning, you know, double counting on it. If we link that back into the subprime question, as I remember, the issue of subprime is related to quite correctly, is not an issue. I think the bigger issue may, however, be that from a broader financial stability issue, is that in what markets perceived to be emerging market issues, if there could be any spillover or any contagion which may take place. I think it's important to say that in South Africa at the moment, given the interest rate cycle that we've gone through, we did see, as we pointed out, that there is definitely a worsening trend in terms of the overdue of the book, particularly the mortgage book. But it's not anything out of kilter, it's not anything disproportionate terms. And as I said, there is security and sufficient provisions that are in there. And the important issue is obviously the continued identification of any potential bad debt as and when it does arise. I think it's vitally important that it's always good to bring the bad news early rather than trying to suppress it. Once one's management in banks maybe suppresses bad debt, and that's when I think a problem arises. Because incorrect decisions are then taken by incorrect strategic decisions are taken by the management in terms of looking at what the overdue position is, and if that is being suppressed, then obviously people would decide to rather carry on growing the book when in fact one would work at an office of view. That is where risk management comes in, that is where internal audit comes in, that is where compliance would come in, and that is where external audit would come in. So I don't believe that we have a big problem in our hands as far as that is concerned. I was very interested, and maybe I would like to ask some more detail about the excess charges or the charges for exceeding limits in terms of the non-year account of concerns. I think suffice to say that in terms of the Bank Act, we don't supervise the micro issues which take place there. I think the new National Credit Act actually falls that way, where consumer issues are being handled. But if there are any disagreeable behaviour on the part of management, then I think it's something which we would be very interested to learn about and could approach. Maybe we could have a bilateral on that, that we could maybe do something about that. But certainly, what our experience of the Zambia Council is that well in terms of the extent of the growth in the number of accounts that have been opened. You know, that's all well I'm talking in terms of the purpose of the outreach. In terms of what the fees are, I would not be correct for me to offer a comment in that regard. I could not answer that. Neither of us. But certainly if there are issues there, we could engage in that.
I think Mr. Mugunia was follow up on the bank, provide the necessary information, because I mean, it's actually the conduct of the bank to the consumer. We might expect value to be happy that that account is reaching out to those people, and yet there might be that exploitation taking place. And I would imagine that you actually need a message to be received.
I don't say that the commissioner is being one of the big charges. It comes from there. So I think they have to submit their reports and then that's the fair measure of that account when they see the limit. The transaction charge is just what it wants to be inspected. The transaction part. And they don't even know the description. I mean, this is on the table of commissioner to carry on the research. I think that's what it is.
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
I don't understand how, in terms of your report, you're indicating that when it comes to the religious activities, it's mainly for concert. So I just want to establish whether the other instruments like stops, options, are not well developed in South African market, in our South African financial system. What really is happening there? My last question is, in your report, you seem to be concerned about the pronunciation of credit, especially by the chain outlet and cell phone operators. What is the problem with them issuing credit to the public? What are your concerns? Yeah, and also with regard to the net open forward position, are we not drifting to the situation where we want to win? First, you know, there's quite a number of fluctuations in according to your report. Basically, the fluctuations were quite high, and I see now we also spent quite a high figure, I think, it's about 14 billion or something. Is this not an indication that we might be switching to where we were in the past when we had a fixed exchange rate and now under a floating exchange rate? And also combating illegal deposit taking. You say approximately 40 unregistered businesses or investment schemes were investigated by the department in 2006. Perhaps a question that was asked earlier on with regards to reporting to FICA and stuff like that. But yes, these are cases that were investigated because these people were illegally taking deposits. What has been the level of success of these investigations?
What we have seen is that the interest rate drop is quite a large other proportion of that market. But in the main, over the past couple of years, not something which has grown tremendously in South Africa. I think it's a fairly smaller market than what we have seen. So it's not that the development is not there, but the various products are there. You take a look at the capital problems, the fraud, corruption, etc. Those are there. And a lot of them also get traded by the particular houses which are not bank controlled. And so they fall within the banking system. But insofar as the banking system is concerned, that the benefit is there, the products are available, but we have seen somewhat of a tapering or a letting out of these. I think we had an initial period where derivatives were starting up in South Africa. And it's reached the level now where it's really ongoing. And then insofar as the proliferation of credit is concerned, the main issue was there was that one actually had to ensure that the member of the public knew that they were actually dealing with a bank. For example, if I'm going to start a clothing retailer who may be offering a loan, but the loan is actually on the books of a bank, and that the client should actually know that the credit assessment has been done by the bank, even though one may be receiving a statement from the retailer, but that one knows that one is dealing with the bank, and one may very well choose not to take the credit from the retailer, but one's own credit facilities that one may have with the bank. So this is a small issue, but just to make sure that came in line. Then as regards the net open position, the position is within the 10% of net capital, within that guideline, that's 3.5-4% level. What one also does find is that a number of these fluctuations take place as big global corporate activity takes place. So I think we've seen a large amount of corporate activity from abroad, which is being involved in a number of investment then also forms part of the bigger operation, the so-called securitization operation, which the financial markets have gotten of the central bank undertake, and that banks would then be taking those conditions or not taking them, but they would be interacting and transacting with the central bank as part of the money market operation. So certainly we don't see that there is any excessive build-up of foreign exposure which is taking place. And quite a number of positions in the final report are then also hedged out back into some other foreign operations. As regards to the illegal deposit taking, there are, as you previously mentioned, these operations are unfortunately still taking place in South Africa, in the main driven by greed on the part of both the perpetrator as well as the investor. The success rate, as I said, we've had four really big ones which have been successfully thrown down. Some of those were in the hundreds of millions of rand. The investigators which work together with our legal department on that do prepare documentation, and that is passed over to law enforcement for law enforcement to take the necessary action and steps in terms of the judicial system of the country. So a number of them have been closed down, and some of the really big ones that we have been stopped in the tracks. I think we have one or two in the Vaal Triangle area where substantial sums of money, hundreds of millions of rand. From the longer we've had some, we had one which was in the Tshwane area, which has also been held down. And I think the interesting part of these is these are never easy, in the sense that one is always dealing with people who really fight. And as I said, it's becoming more and more sophisticated as time has gone. So one has to really ensure that we have the proper skills to handle the sophistication of the case. I think that's a question. I'm not sure.
Yes, I wasn't listening carefully enough, but with the prosecution, how many people were convicted?
In terms of prosecution, I'm not sure how many how many people have been convicted. We haven't had feedback from the law enforcement on that action. Unfortunately, with these illegal deposit taking schemes, like anything that is illegal, one doesn't know it's there until somebody complains. And invariably what happens is nobody complains as long as they're receiving their lucrative return. And once they stop receiving the lucrative return, by that stage already the scheme is probably in financial trouble. And it's at that point in time that the complaints are being received. So one is always receiving these complaints at the end of the road when the perpetrator has already started to say, keep the money, and people are not getting in the road. Thank you, Mr. Mugunga.
Just as an input on the implementation of the national payment system, If there are any challenges that you can point out to, you are expected to comply with all the FICA requirements, less than when you are a South African, but you have a number of people coming to our country from time to time, of course, green skills with our payment system, wherein they can use local ATMs and whatnot. To what extent will we have been able to detect challenges, if any, in this regard? And the last one is on the corporate exchange, the bill that is coming. If you have any specific interaction with us, would it also be, just not too sure whether it would also be residing within your domain, if you could, of course, if you could just comment on that.
I mean, on the API side, the people that are coming into the national payment system would be, need to be vetted or approved by the national payment system department of the central bank. There is an NPS Act which the national payment system department has administered. And as part of that act, the certain processes, et cetera, would form part of that. What has also happened is that I think it is right in the process at the moment where the NPS is revising their take on procedures for people who want to be part of the payment system, and certainly the certain proper issues regarding the people who are part of that. So far as I understand how they are handling that. I hope that answers your question. On the cooperative bank book, we have had interaction with that, and I think as I understand the initial stages of that, there would be two parts to the supervision of the cooperative bank book. And I think the threshold was 20 million in some of the collecting. And those, the entity would be greater than that, would be supervised or sort of regulated by the central bank, and those that would be left, I think, would be part of another regulatory body which the cooperative bank calls into existence. And the central bank, in terms of the government executive committee, has looked at certain frameworks in terms of briefing as to how best to accommodate that portion of the bill which would need to be supervised by the central bank. So that's on that.
Thank you. Very nice. Comment.
Chair, I don't know whether it's a business liberal corporation.
Okay.
I want to remind the presenter that All regulations are coming to Parliament. And this is about this committee which has to look into them and discuss So there are no regulations which you say that when you ask here what regulation you say, this committee doesn't have a preview of that. I want to assure that this committee, all regulations pertaining to finance issues, this committee The second one, chapter 2.
That's a solution.
Yeah. The status of the report because their English is interesting. I think that as a teacher, you should say this presentation provides an executive summary and this appraisal of the 2006 annual report, blah blah blah, and so forth. The presentation does not replace the 2006 annual report and should be read in conjunction. Then those are the issues which you have to look into.
You are reading the presentation.
Yes.
The report. Yes. Okay. It says this presentation does not replace it. But if there are any discussions here, you can't fault that would not be a reflection on the report itself. The report is a separate document. Okay, yeah, no, it's because Yes, above, I mean, I think I understand the purpose of that law, of the case is the title, yes. The document that holds is the title of the form. Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Kruger and Mr. Bates. It was quite a heavy presentation, and we didn't seem like a time. We had anticipated staying here at 5 o'clock. You've made sure that it does not happen. And thank you for that. I look forward to further engagement with yourself. And that you'll make sure that you get good lunch when we leave from the Reserve Bank on Friday, because that will be our last day. So it's one of the reasons why you were treated the way you are treated. So, yeah. Thank you very much. The commission meets tomorrow at 9:30 to take a report from the special section office of the National Treasury. We also anticipate that we will be able to finish earlier than the schedule time. We want to finish it. We'll finish by one of the commissioners that are. You control the time. If you are there to 5 o'clock, I can do that tomorrow. Okay. Thank you very much. Let me say a pleasure to the end of the session. Thank you very much.